Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Community Focus. WEEI is proud to be part of the community. The following WEEI public service broadcast is brought to you by the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
Community Focus.
You're listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams from the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts.
If you're just tuning in this morning, City Councilor Anissa Asabi George is here at large City Councilor for Boston, and she's running for re-election, but we're finding out more and more about her as a person, what motivates her in terms of her actions and her thought processes as it relates to making decisions impacting people. How did you, Counselor, end up becoming a school teacher?
That's another great question. When I was in high school, I was really engaged. And I remember at one point, one of my high school teachers, you're thinking about, what do I want to do next? What am I going to study in college? I thought I'd go to business school. I think that entrepreneurship is a really important facet of our city and of our story as people, but certainly the story of any immigrant population. Mm-hmm. But at some point, I remember a high school teacher saying, just don't become a high school teacher because that work was so hard. Being a high school teacher is so difficult. And then I thought to myself, again, okay, maybe that's what I'll end up doing. But I studied political science in college, had a real desire to be engaged civically, to potentially run for office someday. But I knew I wanted to be engaged in our city, especially in municipal government. It's always been for me, since I was young, a place where I knew you could influence and affect change. No. So I graduated mm-hmm. from college. Mm-hmm. I actually got a job at East Boston High School as the private industry council advisor. So the Boston PIC.
So you went to PIC?
I was at the
Neil
PIC.
Neil Sullivan, working with Neil Sullivan?
I was working for Neil Sullivan, and I was assigned to East Boston High School and immediately fell in love with the culture of the building, with my coworkers, the teachers and the administration in the building, and the kids. And pretty quickly I thought to myself, no, I want to work with these kids in the classroom day in and day out. So I left the PIC, went back to grad school, started a master's in education at UMass Boston, and okay. returned to East Boston High as a teacher.
So your dad took care of the undergrad and you took care of the grad school?
I took care of the grad school. And I tell you, my dad was so proud that I became a teacher because, again, that importance of education. And he wanted me to have a good, stable job, not taking any risks, like just go to work, make a good living, do something that you're passionate about and love. And the fact that I was teaching, he'd come up and visit me at the high school in the middle of the day. Oh, any opportunity he could. He was there.
No, did your mom's influence as being a teacher have anything to do with that?
No,
as well?
Actually, my mother always says, oh, I couldn't mm-hmm. take the classroom. She taught for a number of years, taught French. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't born with a language gene, which is so awful and embarrassing. But she taught for a number of years in Taunton, in public schools in Taunton, and came back to Boston, tried to get into Boston. And I think I was young at that point, and maybe my brother had just been born. And it was easier. My parents were really just struggling with trying to make it all work. So my mom ended up staying at home for a little bit with me and my brother, and she started taking care of neighbors' children to sort of make it worth it so she could be at home with me and my brother, and never returned to the classroom. And she'd come up every now and then and visit me, or if there was a school event, I'd bring them. Because I think really your work should be an extension of your family, and as much as you can engage it makes the work that much more important. And for my mom, she makes jokes every now and then that she.
How old is your mom now?
My mother is. Oh, I'm not telling you that.
No,
she
no, no.
would actually no, be no, very no. upset if I said that out
no,
loud.
No, but don't tell me how old your mom is. But just tell me, I can figure it out.
Yep. So my mother was born in 1950.
Okay. You know, you said that with a straight face. And I'm here to help.
We're going to edit this portion out somehow. We're going to, when she's listening, we're going to make loud racket right at this minute.
Because you said that your grandparents met here and there, yeah. and your mom was born, you and I was out of World War II from 1915, so beep, 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 bop, I got
You've got smart listeners. They have figured it
they
out
They already
already.
Figured it out, yeah. It out Can already. Somebody text me? 617-869-6475. Text me what that number is.
Oh, goodness. So, and then my mother ended up actually, we live in Dorchester, and she ended up working at the Boston Globe as a telephone operator.
Okay.
And that's where she retired from a few years ago.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yep. So she was close to home and always, always handy. And when I started my own family, it was great to have my parents close by.
Wow. That is such a way of just capturing. So you're a teacher. You've been involved, and you live in Dorchester.
I do.
You're a daughter of Dorchester.
I am.
You've been involved in quite a few activities, so you haven't just been sitting at home.
No,
class.
And being engaged and being able to be a part of the community is really important to me. And I think back mm-hmm. on my own dad's experience, especially, that he never had that as a young person because
well, he couldn't be involved in
yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was constantly working.
You were either working or going to school. And those are your, you'd find that moment for a quick soccer game for sure. But you were working or going to school.
AKA European football.
European football. And for me, sort of that civic life called early, like I said, mm-hmm. in high school, I was engaged from day one on, in student government. I was involved in BSAC, the Boston Student Advisory Council that works with the school department and the school committee. I eventually was involved in a state student advisory council where we did some political action statewide around education issues and teenagers. And that, for me, sort of kicked off a life of being engaged in my community, from my local civic association mm-hmm. to being a part of the Dorchester Day Parade Committee, which is a whole lot of fun.
You're president of the Dorchester Civic Association, or Savin Hill.
Columbia Savin Hill Civic Association. And I'm also a member of my health center's board, the Dot House Health Center, Dorchester House Health Center. And, for me, having, being a part of the conversation and being a part of those that are making decisions that can impact the lives, both in a fun way when we think mm-hmm. about planning a parade and celebrating a neighborhood, but then I think about my work on the Dot House Health Board of Directors, and we're thinking about how do we help our residents across our community access high-quality care, both medical care and mental health care, and that work continues in my work as a city councilor.
So let me say this, and I want you to give me an honest answer, because now you're articulating in a very, very impressive way how you have evolved, but yet you've been consistent with the fundamental belief of what you thought you were supposed to do. But tell the listening audience, what was it like when you walked into the city council chambers with that deer look?
I never had the deer look. I've been waiting for this day. Never had that deal.
I was like, I know what I said I was going to do, but now I'm here.
Yeah, no, I signed up for this challenge and I took it. I will say the day, a little bit of my electoral history. I ran for the first time in 2013 and lost that first race.
You got elected in
2015. And got elected in 2015, beat an 18-year incumbent. It's the third time in Boston's history that has happened. I'm very proud of that accomplishment. Not so much the beating of somebody else, but being elected to do this work that I think is so important.
This will be your third election now.
This will be now. I've been reelected once. This will be my second election for my third term.
Wait a minute, 2015, 17, 19.
Yep,
okay, so
it'll
be the second time.
But after that, when I ran the first time in 2013, certainly the goal wasn't to lose. I had a successful loss. I placed fifth out of the top four win. So for me, coming out of nowhere, initially being pulled to finish 12th out of 19 initial candidates in that at-large race, to then in the final finish fifth, was hugely successful for me. My kids, I have four boys. One of them, who's highly competitive, was very disappointed in that loss. And for me, it was, obviously disappointing. I learned a lot. I met some incredible people.
You learned more about yourself.
I learned so much more about my city, because for me, my world had been Dorchester and East Boston. And so, you know, I had friends in other parts of the city, family in other parts of the city, but running for office forces you, because if you want the job, you've got to meet the people. And so to meet residents across our city,
20
to
other neighborhoods,
build those relationships and to understand the complexities of each of those neighborhoods was really a gift to be able to experience that. And there's no better excuse than to run for office to meet these people. And then I'd play a little game with myself and try to identify, oh, this person is just like this other person in this other neighborhood, because we all love this city. And the challenges are
the same. We really do.
We maybe rank sort of what's most important in a particular neighborhood slightly different, but we all want great schools for our kids. Mm-hmm. We want great schools for either our own children or our neighbors' children. We want certainly safe streets. We want to end violence across our entire city, but we know that it is mostly focused in a couple of neighborhoods. We want to make sure that you can get to and from work easily, that we can mitigate traffic, that we can create easier, you know, better transportation systems for sure, mm-hmm. that where we can lay down bike lanes, we do it quickly, and that we're looking for other opportunities to do more of that across the city, and that we have affordable housing so that my kids, my neighbor's kids, that my brother and my sisters can afford to live in this city for the long term, that my mother can age at home and in place, and that the cost of living in the city doesn't get too burdensome for her. But then through my work, especially my work around family homelessness, that our families and the 5,000 students in the Boston Public Schools who are experiencing homelessness can find stable housing here in the city that I know that they love.
The only thing that I would add to your list is that I want to be able to walk to a park in my neighborhood.
Yes, you do. And and we've set some aggressive goals mm-hmm. at the city that every resident live within 10 minutes of a park.
We need to make sure
that those parks are not just pocket parks and sitting parks, which is important to have. As a mother of four boys, and I'm an athlete, kind of, sort of, I used to be more of an athlete, but I want to make sure that we have active park space too, mm-hmm, so that mm-hmm. kids can play baseball and softball, that kids can play soccer and flag football, and my kids also unfortunately play tackle football, but mm-hmm. that we have spaces for that active engagement for young people, for young people who want to continue playing sports like I try to, and for our older residents too, that they've got public park spaces, green spaces, mm-hmm. where they can enjoy a breath of fresh air, because we do happen to live in very tight quarters mostly across our city.
It is.
And our public parks are often the only backyard. I'm very lucky. I feel so lucky to have a backyard now for my kids to grow up in. My husband and I both grew up in three family triple deckers, no backyard. So our parks and our open space were critical components of our upbringing.
You're speaking about the experience of many Bostonians, so whether it's Franklin Park or any of the parks that are in the city, or even the land down off around the Charles, just open space near the water is so vitally important. You serve, though, on several committees. You serve on the Civil Rights, Community Preservation, Education, Healthy Women and Families and Communities, I think Homeless and Mental Health Recovery. Talk about those areas and why is that important for the listening audience to know why they should send you back to the city council to continue that work.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So I'm very lucky to be the only counselor that chairs two committees. I chair education, and every single day mm-hmm. Take my experience as a high school teacher and a BPS parent to that work. I love looking at it from a 30,000 foot level, but I am not afraid ever to get into the weeds, and I often do find myself in the weeds.
We're going to go there. We're going to go there.
That inside baseball.
We're going to go inside that baseball park in a minute, but go ahead.
I also chair the Committee on Homelessness, Mental Health, and Recovery, and that's about individuals experiencing homelessness, but more so for me, it's about families experiencing homelessness, because as a city, we've taken a leadership role in the individual piece. We have not taken a leadership role in the family piece. So I'm very proud of my work in that space.
But you said you focus in on families, though. Is that correct?
I'm focusing on all of it.
Okay.
But I've got a particular focus on families experiencing homelessness, because as a city, it hasn't been a priority for us. And those are our kids in our schools, those are our families in all of our neighborhoods. We have 125 schools in Boston Public Schools. Mm-hmm. We have students experiencing homelessness in every single one of our schools. And that's we have a huge responsibility to take care of these kids and to take care of their families. The other part of that committee, it's homelessness, mental health, and recovery. Mm-hmm. For me, helping all of our residents access mental health care. I've called for the formation of a mental health commission so that our residents, and New York set this goal, and anything that New York can do, we can do better. And New York has created a plan so that every resident who wants to access mental health services can. We need to follow suit with that here in the city.
Well, I fully agree, because we recently just had where the correction officer got beat by 20-some-odd people going to a methadone mile. Right near in Roxbury. So as a city county, at large city councilor, is that troubling for you?
Oh, it's all troubling for me. And the third leg of that committee is recovery.
Right.
So how are we as a city working towards recovery? Oftentimes, homelessness, mental health, and recovery or addiction intersect. Sometimes they don't, and I don't think we should ever make assumptions that mm-hmm. they're always intersecting. But what we see happening at Mass and Cass is a very direct example, perfect example, of where some of our most vulnerable with experiencing a crisis, where that intersects. There's many of those individuals in that area are experiencing homelessness. Many of them are having issues around mental health and how do they access
as addiction as well.
As well as substance use disorders. So how are we as a city supporting those people in this time of need? And
it's looking bad right now.
It's
looking bad for a while.
It's been looking bad for a while, and a lot of that has been attributed. And I think initially it was appropriate. I don't believe it's no longer. I believe it's no longer appropriate. Initially, that was contributed to the closing of the Long Island Bridge.
So we're going to try to blame Quincy?
No. So I think initially it was when the bridge was closed. Mm-hmm. We had to respond. We had an immediate crisis, immediate need. We have.
We're supposed to have opened up so many other beds.
We've replaced the beds that were initially on Long Island mm-hmm. in the programs. The problem has gotten worse. The crisis has gotten worse. And
why is that?
Because addiction has gotten...
Or is it more people from outside of Boston that are converging into Boston?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. And, okay. and this conversation, I think, speaks to the complexity of the issue. When addiction and substance use disorders intersect with mental health issues and not having enough support services for those that are having a mental health crisis, and then we add homelessness to the mix. The data that comes from the two city-run shelters in that area, Woods Mullen for the women, Southampton Street for the men, mm-hmm. since I took office in 2016, there's been a significant increase in the number of individuals coming from outside of the city and outside of the state and region looking for support services. In 2016, 40% of our guests who are using and staying at our shelters were not from the city of Boston. That number...
That's significant.
That number is now 65% or so. Where technically it's 60, pushing 70. The newest data is showing us pushing 70. So I'm calling it 60-65%. Now, when I first took office, I thought, why do we continue to do this work as a city? These other cities and towns need to step up. They need to help their residents because their residents are experiencing trauma, crises, addiction, mm-hmm. mental health issues. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we seem to be almost the only place providing these services. So we've got individuals literally and figuratively stuck at Mass and Cass. The services bring them there and services that they desperately need. But then there's not great resources for them after.
I see them every day. They're sleeping under the bridge. They're sleeping across the street in the various lots. They have tents on the backside of Boston Water and Sewer. It's like there by the grace of God, there go I.
Right,
so I'm not seeing this from a judgment perspective, because then you see them panhandling the whole nine yards. But it's just, we need to do better because the optics are not good for our city.
Right. Well, the optics aren't good. And that's certainly something that we have to think about and worry about when we think about our city mm-hmm. and, you know, wanting our city to remain this place that people want to come to visit, to send their kids to go to school, to come work. But, Aside, I mean, and the optics are a piece of it, but most importantly is caring for people who are sick and making sure that they can access resources that are going to help them be well. So how do we get to that point? Because the issues are certainly complex. The services are stretched thin. The pressure on the system and that continuum of care is... And I think that we've seen it at a breaking point. And so my worry about what's happened over the last few days, in particular in that area, is thinking about individuals who are in distress, who are in crisis, who are vulnerable, who are sick, who are dealing with serious substance use disorders and often co-occurring mental health issues, often co-occurring homelessness. How are we making sure that we're going to continue maintaining a connection to them? Because we're all desperate for human connection and making sure they get the services they need, but still maintaining order in community.
And I think that that's the challenge that we have as a city, because we're looking, you mentioned in early in your comments about affordable housing, where in Roxbury we have a disproportionate amount of affordable housing, and then that's overlaid with a lot of government buildings, which means that the tax base is no longer. So if you look at 71% of Boston's budget is based upon property taxes. Mm-hmm. So if we're not paying taxes and we get a disproportionate, and we don't have time to go into the proliferation of sober homes, because that's a whole nother bill of wax.
I can come on another hour.
We'll come on an hour and we'll talk about it because it's so important. But the question I have for you going as we get ready to close toward the end of our second time together, why should people reelect you?
Well, for me, it's about a proven record of accomplishment, of work, of being present in the community, myself and my team. I'm very proud of the work that we've been able to do as an office and being present in the community and listening and being connected to our residents across the city on the issues that matter, but also responding with action and responding with work, holding the city accountable and the school department accountable so that we have a full-time nurse in every one of our school buildings, so that we're working
No more traveling nurses.
And the goal is by December, no more traveling nurses. We had 44 schools at the end of the school year that had a part-time nurse. Okay. So nurses that were being shared between buildings.
Is that the part of the increase in the school budget where they were going to be?
Yep. I held a hearing earlier this year asking for a policy that would mandate a full-time nurse and a full-time behavioral health specialist in all of our school buildings.
Okay.
We got the full-time nurse piece. We got an increase in the mental health, behavioral health specialists in our schools.
Mm-hmm.
Because still, if today were a school day, half of our schools at any moment don't have somebody that can respond immediately in the building to a kid who is having a mental health crisis.
And what about trauma?
It's so tied to trauma. Because we know kids are coming with challenges that they bring from home, they bring from community, they bring from experience. And it's playing out in the classroom. It's playing out in the schoolyard. It's playing out on the ball field. And we need to make sure as a city that we're supporting kids and meeting them where they're at, giving them the services they need where they're at. So we've gotten to this full-time nurse piece, and the school district has been pretty aggressive in their hiring, but they want to make sure they have the right nurses in the right building. So we've got culturally competent nurses, that they have the linguistic ability to communicate with kids. So the next leg is to now push them on the mental health specialists, the behavioral health specialists, the counselors, and the school psychologists, so that they're in all of our buildings too. We saw an increase in that. We'll push for more, especially in the next budget cycle.
Talk about, if you will, the level of individual families that are coming to our 55,000 students in Boston Public School System, and I think there's a high percentage of them that get free lunch. Why is that
all
important?
All of our kids get free lunch. Because it's important that no kid has to show up at the lunch line and
breakfast as well.
Themselves.
They get breakfast too, right? Breakfast,
well.
Lunch?
And we are working. I'm advocating for breakfast after the bell in all of our schools.
In other words, they stop when the bell rings. Yep. You don't eat.
You don't eat. And we know that buses are often arriving to school a little bit late. Kids are running in the door. Think about our high school kids. A lot of my work has been around later high school start times, because half of our high schools start before 7:30 in the morning. That's too early. So we want to make sure our kids are awake and ready to learn. And a big part of that is being fed and, you know, getting out of the house super early in the morning, not having access to breakfast, having to wait to lunch, and then having an extended day on the other end. Our kids aren't having, you know, we know that, I think statistically.
I would love to see them go to school full time year round, if you ask me, in terms of not having the summers off.
But well, as a teacher, a little bit of a break. But, no, but those breaks need to be productive. It doesn't have to be a traditional classroom, a productive break.
But here's the difference. What I see is that when they graduate from Boston Public School System, they go to Bunker Hills and the other colleges, they find that they are going to need additional services in order for writing, reading comprehension, et cetera, that they need in order to perform at the next level.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying that, is that when they have the summer off, we have to start over again when they come back in September.
Yeah, no, and those summers should be productive summers. So I think that out of a traditional classroom, I guess
productive summers in the school.
Well, it could be in community, though.
Okay.
Our community centers are a place, our local libraries. There are other things that can happen that are productive. My children are, they have an easy summer. But I'm a former teacher, so they've got a binder. They've got their summer reading.
They've got reading got assignments. Do they have to write reports, too?
I make them write reports. And I've got a binder.
Now you're starting to sound like your dad.
I want them engaged, because that summer loss is a true thing.
It really is. It's like, you know, you're slipping.
And my boys now are going into 8th and 9th grade, and so schoolwork is getting more real. The math is getting harder. They now have, you know, as they're entering high school, there's a language component. And I want my kids as prepared as they can be. And it's important that we use all of these opportunities wisely. Doesn't have to be that traditional classroom experience. I was at Hale Reservation yesterday for a tour. They have BPS teachers at the reservation teaching kids in the middle of the day. So they've got their swimming lessons. They've got their high ropes course. And then they take a break for ELA. And then they've got something else going on. They go for another swim. They come back for a math lesson.
Okay.
So that we're still engaging our kids in a thoughtful way over the summer. It's an extended school year.
How many of the 55,000?
Too few.
Okay, so that's the point. So we're doing the right thing. We're just not doing it for enough of the students.
Right, and we've got to be thoughtful and creative about it. There's that summer teens program where these 14-year-old kids who are 13 and 14-year-olds, just too young to really work, but too old to go to a regular traditional little kids camp. You know, we're engaging them in work experiences. There's an academic component to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting a paycheck. You know, so these kids have an opportunity to make a few bucks over the summer, which is a good skill to learn. Remember, back to my dad, it's about work, it's about study, it's about doing good, but it's about also realizing your own self-value. And these opportunities create that for our kids.
Let me spend a few minutes with you before we close out, because we got a new superintendent of schools. Dr. Chang left. There was a really an explosive situation when the school closures was on the docket, and the parents basically were saying, hell no, we're not going to take this. And so we have a direction where school attendance is dwindling. But yeah, people don't want to see schools closed within their neighborhoods. How are you, as the chair of the education committee, wrestling with these nuances within the school department to make sure that we get a proper education for all of these kids, reduce the cost of busing?
Right.
But we'll come back to
that. Let's really reduce the cost of busing.
Right.
Because I think, a big part of the answer.
That's right.
But it's the nuance. So thinking about making sure that kids have access to athletics and academic programming that are meaningful.
Quality
education, right?
Okay.
And those have to be delivered by high quality teachers, any of our academic programs in our schools. But it's also about making sure that we've got programs that our kids are interested in. Think about Madison Park, and we can talk another time at length about improving vocational and technical education.
Kevin McCaskill is coming on in 2 weeks.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, we've been,
so that's
a
shout out, Kevin.
Hard, and Kevin's been doing an amazing amount of work in a building that needs significant investment from a facilities standpoint, a lot more support from a programmatic standpoint, and then an application process. And we've talked at length at public hearings about Madison needing an application process. So kids are in that building that are looking to take advantage of programs that are there. And they don't need to know that they want to go into the carpentry program or into the culinary arts program. But they need to say that I'm open to learning about these things. Mm-hmm. I'm open to a potential career or college experience that being at Madison Park is going to lend itself to. But it's also about making sure that schools have, that they do have beautiful facilities.
Let me
that
ask you,
families
let me,
feel I'm good
I'm going to cut you off real
kids.
Quick. We got some schools that are doing some phenomenal work. We got three exam schools where the minority participation at those schools, I think Boston Latin is probably the lowest between the Academy and John B. O'Brien. And so I think the minority participation, Latinos and African Americans at the John D. O'Brien and Academy are great. Boston Latin, it is not.
I went to the O'Brien's. I've got two boys at Latin Academy and two boys at Latin School. And I think part of the answer to diversifying and increasing diversity, especially at Latin School, is about kids being able to see themselves there. And
it's a cottage industry where people who have means can put their children and be prepared to take those exams.
Yep.
And children who come from homes that don't have the means, they don't have the same access.
And that's what we should be doing. That's our job as a city, is to make sure the kids
We make sure that happens? You got a new superintendent. We got an opportunity to change the slate. So I'm pushing real hard, because my time is coming short. So that's what I'm asking you, as you're looking at your vision as to be reelected, is that something that you will be willing to take on?
No, that's something that we have taken on. And it's something that we look at, and I have conversations about every single day at City Hall, both formally and informally. We have to look at how our kids are exposed to the exam schools in particular. It's how they are prepared to take the tests.
You think the superintendent She's shown
some real initiative to take that on. But the other question is, our other high schools need to also be high quality schools.
That's right.
And sometimes the conversation is just about the exam schools. It should really be about East Boston High, Charlestown High, Tech Boston.
I got to bring you back, because there were 81 schools that were destroyed or reused that in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan. So when West Roxbury and South Boston start talking about neighborhood schools, there's never an acknowledgement of the loss of those other schools. We need to bring you back. If you've been listening to the Community Focus program, you've been listening to Anissa Asabi George, who's an at-large city councilor. I am so grateful that you came in. And for us at the community, I want you to say, tune in next week. Thank you for tuning in. Go out and have a blessed day and a blessed week.
Community Focus. Thanks for listening to Community Focus with Dr. Darnell Williams. Be sure to tune in next week for another segment of Community Focus.
Community Focus.
This is Sports Radio 93.7, WEEI and WEEI.com, Boston.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Good morning, everyone. This is Darnell Williams. I am your host here on the Community Focus program, welcoming you once again to have an opportunity to have a conversation with you about issues impacting our city, our region, and our nation. And this week is no exception, where we try to bring in personalities and luminaries in the city of Boston. And that is, I'm very excited about our guest who's in the studio today. But let me just do a few moments of just talking about what's going on this week in our country that really kind of gives us a chill of my spine in terms of what's going on around the globe, the challenges of what's happening at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, what happened in El Paso, Texas, what happened in Dayton, Ohio, the loss of life and the gun debate that's going on and background checks and people backing away from it. It's just really, I just want us to be able to figure out one way that we can deal with these issues, that we don't demonize the person who we happen to disagree with. That's where it seemed that we it's better to call somebody a name and give them a monkey. And I think Mitch O'Connell is called Moscow Mitch. Then you got Sleepy Joe. They're using all these nasty phrases about people, and none of this stuff is true. But they're catchy for Pocahontas. All of that stuff is so mean-spirited. How about talking about what the issues are? How about we talk about what are the things that we need to do to work together? And so I use those words not to give them legs. I don't use those statements to give legs to it. I only use it to illustrate how far we have fallen from the civil discourse, where you would debate somebody on the stage and I would debate against you in terms of my ideas and what my vision is for America, rather than to call you names. We grew up in an era where it said sticks and stones may break my bones, but words could never hurt me. Or I put a popsicle stick on your shoulder and draw a line in the sand and say, I double dare you to cross that line. And we would fight and scuffle, but we go home today as friends. Now if I bump against you on a train, somebody pulls out a 9mm and pops me. It's like, where is this stuff coming from? Such anger, such vitriolic hatred that we have towards one another. Where if you peel back the color of the skin, we're all the same. You got a heart, two eyes, a nose, and a heart that needs blood. And if I'm the same blood type, regardless of what you think about me, if I have enough blood to share, I'll give it to you. I used to do the blood bank, but I haven't given it in a few years. So I don't know what's up with that. but they always need blood. And then you think about where we are in just terms of people, that 23 people running for the president of the United States. And I can tell you, you take about 13 of them, I can give them a message. Go home. Because it ain't going to happen. And everybody around you knows that. Nobody's willing to tell you that. And you spend all this time and energy crossing the country and telling people that I think I can win. Win what? So my guest was laughing at me, but I know I'm telling the truth. Everybody can say, that ain't going to happen. I don't know what day you rolled out of the bunk bed one day and said, I think I'm going to be president. Or you rolled out of bed, I think I'm going to run for this office, and nobody has ever seen you on the front line doing nothing. But yet now you want to take one of the highest offices in the land because you said that I got experiences. Well, that's how we got where we are today. And so all I'm saying to you is that there's got to be a progressiveness about who we are as a people, who we are as a nation. And this identity politics, I think it's a real sad case that the two congresswomen were not allowed to visit Israel. I've been to Israel twice, and I had to go. I had the good fortune to go with folks from the AJ. I can't think of the names. I'm trying to have a moment, but I went there with them to visit both the Palestinians as well as the Jewish Israeli side. And I had a good eye-opening of an experience. I walked the steps of Christ where I was, you know, we went into the Dead Sea and put the mud and all that stuff on us. And so there are a lot of hot spots. What's transpiring in Hong Kong, the million people who are protesting, what's going on from mainland China. If you're not looking at what's going on in Afghanistan and Iran and Iraq, we're talking about ISIS is dead and 64 people were killed at a wedding. They're not dead. And so we got so many issues that are going on across the globe. Our standing in the world stage in terms of our humanitarian nature, in terms of where we are as a nation, is being eroded. And yet we want to find time to be divisive around these issues. And so when I think about what education means and where we are, and I think about where, if you go back to where this all started, I believe it was the Cotton Exposition in 1896, and Booker T. Washington stood up and he made a statement that just like the fingers on our hands are separate and equal, that's the way we should be as black folks. And lo and behold, they turned that into a policy. It wasn't until 1954, until the Brown versus the Board of Education, that they said that that was unconstitutional. And they had this little black girl sitting on the court, a Thurgood Marshall had this little black girl sitting there. And they put two dials in front of her. One was black and one was white. And they said, well, which one do you want to be? And the little black girl said, I want to be like the white girl. Because everything that was in her world's view was told to be was negative. And everything that was in the world's view from the white doll's perspective was good. So denying our own blackness was part of the day, the psyche. And so when we think about education, it was the segregation of the schools, which was the law of the land. It was against the law to teach a black person how to read and write. But here we are today, we are being resegregated. So we have a guest in the studio that we're going to talk about some of these issues. But education has always been at the center of the what I call it the vehicle out of poverty was education. If you they can repossess that car, you know that, right? If you don't make that car note and you don't make it the second month, third month, they're coming to get it. They can take the clothes off of your back. They can take repossess your house. They can take a whole lot of things. But the only thing in this society that no one can ever take from you is your education. You can take that to the grave. And so if you are the kind of person that recognizes if you weren't able to do it, because a lot of our parents were not able to go as far as we were or could because the circumstances were different. But what they had was common sense. They said, we're going to pave the way for you to do better than what we did. And then every generation after that said, we want our kids to do better than what we did. The only problem was that we made it look easy for our kids and we did not give them a connection back to the struggle. So they think that they made it on their own. They think you just a walking ATM machine. And they don't pay for no cell phones. They have more crackberries in their hands and their pockets than you can shake a stick at. And they've exhausted the insurance on those cell phones because they broke it so many times. Am I speaking to anybody in the studio? And then I raised the kid. I raised a hand up at one of the sessions and I asked him, how many of y'all got cell phones? Every hand went up in there. And the other kid is, I said, how many of y'all pay for y'all cell phone bills? All the hands went down except for one. And this kid's got to be 13. And I asked him, I says, well, what is your hustle? And do you need any help? How you gonna be 13 paying for a cell phone bill monthly? You gotta have something going on. I need to talk to you after this class.
In private.
In private. I gotta have a sidebar with this kid. He might need some guidance. But anyway, I'm having fun because I think the day is just a blessed day to be here. My guest, I'm gonna introduce him, Kevin McCaskill, who is the executive director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Darnell.
Thank you. I know I got you rolling.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is like sitting at my kitchen table, and it could be breakfast, lunch, or dinner. We're going to just have a conversation about what it is, who you are, and what do you do, how did you get there, and the values. So I want to welcome you to the Community Focus Program.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm truly honored and humbled.
Yeah. Yeah, the opening was really designed for our listening audience because they're dealing with a lot of these issues.
Absolutely.
And when we think about the Buston Public School System, we have to think about the number of schools. We've got 125 schools in the city of Boston. I believe the count that I saw last, that we were about 57,000 students mm-hmm. in the city of Boston school system, but I think that number was revised now, is down to 55,000 students. So we're losing students. And so this strange debate that we're having about closing schools because of their enrollment, mm-hmm. because a lot of people are sending their school students to independent schools or either to Catholic schools. So that means that there are less students coming into the system.
And also, I mean, in the METCO program, in which our students from Boston actually go into surrounding communities.
Right. And but the money follows those students.
The money follows the student.
Right. So when they go to METCO, we're not mad at them because mm-hmm. I think METCO has produced some great minds. Mm-hmm. And we have three exam schools in the city of Boston, which that's a whole nother debate about the cottage industry around. A lot of kids are families who spend a lot of money to make sure that they are mm-hmm. Experts on the test questions.
Absolutely.
But and know that they can get a private education at the public expense.
Absolutely.
So we know about that. I think I know a little bit about that. But we're going to talk about your school, mm-hmm. but not right at the moment. What mm-hmm. I want to do is talk about, you've been an educator for quite a bit.
32 years.
Okay, so mm-hmm. when you started this job, you had an afro, didn't you?
Well, not quite. I think it's at late 80s, I was shaving it down a little bit.
So tell everybody, where were you? Where did you grow up and where were you born?
Grew up in Paterson, New Jersey.
Okay.
And born and raised in Paterson, went to Paterson Public Schools all through my K through eight experience. I had the opportunity to actually get bussed out of Patterson after eighth grade for my first 2 years of high school into Wayne, New Jersey, at a prep school, believe it or not.
Okay, get out.
And so that was That was the trajectory that changed your life? That was something that was really new to me, where you grow in a neighborhood that is predominantly black, and primarily, you know, predominantly black, but then you're going to a school which is 97% white.
And so therefore, that was a cultural shock for
Culture shock. But, you know, it was my mother's choice, and she said she wanted something better for me. And you know, I went kicking and screaming.
Thank God for mamas.
Oh, my God. I went kicking and screaming, Darnell. Went kicking and screaming. But it was a 2 years where, you know, you really have to prove yourself every day. And to me, the challenge.
Prove yourself in what way?
Prove myself that I was just as smart, had just as much intellect and drive than my counterparts.
So, in other words, they thought you was just a jock.
They thought I was just a jock because I did play all three sports. But also, but coming in, oh, he's, you know, he's the token, and he's just coming up here for an athletic ride. But it was probably my best 2 years of academic performance.
Because you were developing in a way that you would not have gotten at the other school?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's really interesting, because when you think about it, it was never anything magical in the civil rights movement about integration. Integration was never the goal. Mm-hmm. The goal was that how do we get equal resources and capable teachers into each school so regardless of your color, your race, and ethnicity, you can get a quality education.
And that the playing field was as equitable as it could possibly be, where everybody had an opportunity to showcase talents. And, you know, again, and it's unfortunate that even in this day in 2019, we're still talking about inequities in education across the country.
Well, no, because no. Hold on. So, see, the key is that all this stuff is not by accident.
Yeah.
You can go to Oakland, you can go to Newark, and you can go back to Patterson. And I would just do a shout out to the folks that are in Newark. They need to be ashamed of themselves that they're making you come pick up two things of water.
Two packages of water.
Two packages of water, man. Come on, man. Y'all need to get real. And I mean, but we thought Flint was bad. This is just as worse, because they knew.
Exactly.
And so now it's really asking the question that we need to be checking all of our water.
My home state.
Filters didn't even work. Oh, my Lord. So the challenge is that the schools were where they first started out. Mm-hmm. So once again, related back. So there's this intersectionality between poverty and education and resources. That seems to plague us for something that is beyond me.
And it's two words that just go hand in hand. And Darnell, for years and decades, we've both known access and opportunity. Access and opportunity to quality education, access and opportunity to quality housing, and all those things that go with it. And, you know, and it's something, again, I go back, it's 2019. It's 2019.
And we're fighting the same battle.
We're fighting the same battles. It's like the battle that I can recall a conversation with you in your Springfield years. We talk about the plight of black boys.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this has been something going on and been written about for the past 50 or 60 years. And we're still talking about it.
Well, the key is the Kerner Commission report was issued after the riots in 1968, over 100 cities that were burning. And President Lyndon Baines Johnson put the commission together called the Kerner Commission. Mm-hmm. And they came back to report and says we have two Americas, one white and one black, separate and unequal. That was in 1968. Now, here they did the 50-year report and did an analysis of what the Kerner Commission already told them. They told President Johnson, they told his administration, these are the things. And by the way, you are white racism was at fault of why all this stuff was in place. But here are the things that you need to do to fix it. Here we are 50 years later, and they're telling us that we're worse off than we were in 1968.
It's a shame. So
the challenge is that, and then people think that we are race baiting and just exacerbating. What would you say to that?
The truth is right in the pudding. I mean, there's something in which there is such a divide, and that divide has to be identified. And I think and that's why I praise Ayanna Pressley and the work that she's doing down in Washington, D.C., bringing this to light. But I think I always want our fight.
So you're a supporter of the squad.
I tell you, yeah. Well, Ayanna Pressley, well, she spoke at our graduation and tore the house down, but I've been even when she was a city councilor, she's a champion of people.
Yeah, and I heard she was your commencement speaker for 2019.
And it's not just rhetoric, it's putting those words into actionable steps. And that's
it's called policy.
Absolutely.
And legislation.
Absolutely.
But I think that's great. But now we stopped in the middle of you talking about your Paterson, New Jersey experience. I'd like to find out a little bit more about you. How many brothers or sisters that you have?
I was an only child of a working mom, a mom that worked for 14.
So you don't know how to share marbles then, do you?
I didn't have too many marbles to share. we weren't the richest, but it's something where, you know, you have a working mom and a working grandmother who raised me, and when they're consistently working, and you spend a lot of time on your own, but it's a lot of responsibility where they expect you to do most of the things, where you're doing the cooking for yourself, you're doing your own clothes, you're doing chores. So you're really gaining those, you know, those things that some of our children don't seem to have this day and age, but you learn those responsibilities at a very young age. And those have really stuck with me. Working hard, being at your best at all times, and putting your best foot forward and making sure that you never disrespect the house.
What does that mean?
That means when you go out on the street, you are representing this family.
Okay, in other words, because somebody would call home.
And that would be it.
And you know you're going to get it because the call made it before you did.
And, you know, in the neighborhood I lived in, you got it from the time you were on the block to the time you got home. So.
Okay, they said, I'll knock you back in the next week if you don't straighten up.
It was a fact.
So if you had to share with the listening audience, Kevin, what would you say are maybe three, you mentioned working hard and best foot forward and representing the family, but if you had to pick out some values that came out of that are still with you today, what would those values be?
Respect
for what, for yourself?
First and foremost, respect for elders.
For elders, okay.
Respect for your family.
Mm-hmm.
And respect for yourself.
But so basically you're talking about on the third leg of that is self-esteem.
Absolutely.
But do you find that a lot of these young people, and this is not to trash anybody who has tattoos, but I see a lot of young people plaster themselves with a lot of tattoos in order to, I don't know if it's because it's an addiction or they want to get attention. Do you, as an educator, have an orientation of what that means?
Identity, trying to be really
separate themselves.
You know, and some do it in response to honoring a family member, the death of a family member, a neighborhood or whatever. But I just see it a lot of times where they'll get them, one, they see everyone else doing it. Why can't I do it?
Okay, so that's kind of like a group thing?
It's a group, because we see them throughout, and it's amazing how they're getting younger and younger.
They're getting younger, but then they put it in places that, hey, wait a minute, you ain't got a job yet.
Yeah, you're not growing.
You got to put some things where, you know, it's okay if you're going to do it, but you can't put it where, right, if you put something in the top of your forehead and on your cheek.
Yeah, those
like,
are.
Like, yo, what's up with that?
You're bringing way too much attention to yourself, and I think you're really, at that point in time, a conversation.
It's a distraction.
It's a conversation piece, and people shouldn't have that conversation because, again, they'll have an opinion of you, and that might.
And that means that they're not going to have too many conversations.
Yeah, well,
with you.
And you're not going to have too many opportunities.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. So you got some good value. You got respect for elders, respect for family, respect for self,
and the value for education. That was something coming from my grandmother. Did not finish high school.
Okay,
and growing up in Virginia.
Okay, and so she had good common sense, though, right?
She had outstanding common sense. Common sense. Worked as a domestic for her entire career. Her entire career, over 60 years of being a domestic.
Okay.
My mother was a nurse, an RN registered nurse.
In New Jersey?
In New Jersey.
Okay.
In New Jersey. And it was something that was always instilled in me on a daily basis. They were not going to raise, in my grandmother's term, you weren't going to be a hoodlum.
Okay.
That was her favorite
so
line.
So we went from hoodlum, we'll say you ain't going to be no thug.
Exactly, from hoodlum to thug. But those are the values that, you know, that really were impressed upon in that household.
Because you know that phrase they used to say, boy, I brought you into this world.
I'll take you out.
and they meant it.
Absolutely.
So if you were to think about those early years and those values, So how did you go from, where did you go to college?
Ended up going to Western New England College.
Okay, on Wilbraham Road.
Right on Wilbraham Road in Springfield.
Oh, excuse me, I have to correct you. Western University now, right?
My diploma says Western New England College, but they are Western New England University.
Well, you know I'm an AIC guy, right?
Absolutely, right down the street.
And my house is right in between the two of them on Wilbraham Road. So, yeah, I know that good school, good university. And so what did you major in when you were
mathematics. I had my bachelor's degree in mathematics.
So you're a math teacher?
Yes, indeed.
There's very few of us who would choose math because, I mean, I think there's a shortage of math teachers now, isn't it?
Math and science.
Math and science?
And technology.
Why is that?
You know, and it's funny you asked that question, and I think so many times access, and it goes back to my access and opportunity when we're just doing things with respect to our middle school students who are in a prime, I think they're in a prime age to make a selection of going into the STEM field.
Or STEAM.
STEAM now. But it was always, I go back
to STEM.
Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And it's something where it's the way it's taught. The opportunities, the hands-on approach to it, that science and math can be fun, and it can be, you know, raise your curiosity level, your inquisitiveness, and we don't do that. We just teach it as this is what you need to learn
because they don't tell you how to apply it,
but then you got to do well on this test.
I'll be honest with you, because sometimes that stuff can be so dry, man. And I'm just trying to do my darnest to keep my eyes open so you won't mess with me.
But the expansive, again, the technology where it brings this stuff to life. And again, and so I think those are means to
but
get.
But do we have the resources in our schools in order to connect the technology with the learning style?
I think we do. I really think we do. I think administrators have to be very resourceful.
Okay.
Understanding that you may not be able to obtain funding from the system itself, but there are partners out there, technology partners, higher ed partners, there are industry partners who, when they get the call, they move to action. And I think a lot of times we underestimate the value of having an outside partner in higher ed, an outside industry partner who can really aid in that.
You have four partners with Madison Park that we'll talk about in a moment. I believe you have Wentworth, you have Roxbury Community College, Bunker Hill Community College, and I believe you have Benjamin Franklin. And many other folks have been here. So those are very, very solid partners for you to have, because I was a part of that original RocksMap. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I wanted you to really transition. So you went to Western New England College, you got a degree in math, you walked across the stage, but you didn't tell me how did you get from Paterson, New Jersey? You didn't grow up in Paterson. You went to school in Paterson.
And actually finished growing up in Willingboro, which is in South. It's right outside of Camden, where
mother. That's down towards Philadelphia.
Right across the bridge from
Philadelphia. Just so you geography wise, guys. So then, how did you get from there to Western New England?
It was, I didn't want to go to school in New Jersey. For some reason, I just felt that I would be going with my friends, and I knew some of how my friends were going to act, and it might have taken me 7 to 8 years to graduate.
So what girlfriend did you fell out with?
Not a girlfriend, not that time. That'd be the crazy move to make a move for a girl at that age. But I also wanted to play college athletics.
Okay, and so they brought you in.
Western New England was a place that was very interested in me playing basketball.
Basketball?
Which I did for 4 years up there.
But you said you mentioned three sports. Was that just in high school?
In high school.
You played football?
Played football.
Well, you're a tight end?
Believe it or not, a safety.
You're a safety?
Much smaller than I appear right now. Much smaller.
So wait a minute. So when you were in Western New England College, that was before. Now I'm looking at you now.
I grew a little bit in high school. I grew a little bit. The first high school I went didn't have football. But okay. I played football throughout my in the City League in Paterson as from a
Pop
child.
Pop Warner?
Absolutely, and loved it. But when I went to school, they didn't have football. They had baseball and basketball, and I played both.
You played both of those?
And love baseball was always my first love. Baseball was my first love.
Okay, so you're a three-letter man.
Yeah. But again, basketball, one of the things, and I'll share.
Sure.
Had more people, and the girls went to the basketball games.
See, I knew there was a girl in there. I knew there was a girl in there somewhere, man.
Basketball games.
See, he's talking about, no.
I said, I didn't make the decision to go to Springfield for a girl, but not to play basketball.
Well, at least you were focused.
But so again, but I did want to play and participate in college athletics, and West New England did show interest in me playing for
football.
Them, and they were wanting to play in basketball.
Okay.
And so they indicated, you know, a lot of the schools in New Jersey are saying, well, you know, you might have to sit out that first year and you may not get a lot of playing time. West New England says, you come up here, you're going to play. And I ended up playing for 4 years.
Oh, I think that's great. So what would be some of the lessons that you learn in terms of team sport?
Definitely the, you know, working together as a collective for a common goal. I think those things are always important coming out in team sports, being there for one another, always having your brother's back. At all costs, really pushing each other to be the best that you possibly can be, and then most, and just the camaraderie.
Yeah,
the camaraderie.
How would you deal with losing though? How did y'all deal with that?
Not well. Not well. My mother tell you I was a sore loser. So, and it's something where it's, you know, you can't eat, you can't sleep, and you can't wait to the next because you take it out on somebody.
You gotta take it somebody in practice.
In practice the next day, it had to happen that
that's
way.
That's right. So you really, but these are all. If you're just tuning into the Community Focus program, you're listening to my guest Kevin Maskell, who is the executive director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School in Roxbury, right there on Malcolm X Boulevard.
Correct.
And so, Kevin, you've been there, but you also have had some other experiences. And so when we talk about you went to college, and then when you finished Western New England College, where did you go after that?
I ended up working in Philadelphia, went back home, and I worked for several months for Penn Mutual Life Insurance Company in Philadelphia.
Oh, get out. Doing what?
Wasn't selling.
Okay, what were you doing?
I wasn't a salesman, but I worked in their group pensions, pensions. And then they had a massive layoff, and we're talking in the end of 1984, December of 1984, a massive layoff. So as you know, first hired, first to let go.
Okay.
But a good friend of mine.
No surprise there.
Yeah, no surprise whatsoever. 300 of us. And
wow.
So,
that was a massive layoff.
Massive layoff. And so it was during those recession times.
Were you
times.
Living at home at the time?
Thank God I was living at home. Would not have made it on my own.
Okay.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.